Linda, you've got this creative writing process that you've been teaching around the country, sold out crowds, writing the unthinkable. What is the unthinkable?
Well, the unthinkable, you know, when we sit down to write a story, a lot of times people think, okay, well, I need a, you know, you try to figure out what the story is. But if you think about how often this happens, you're walking down the street and some guy passes who wears, for some reason, he's wearing the cologne that guys wore in the eighth grade, like Brute. That was the thing when I was. And suddenly, just as he passes, this entire time of your life comes back. And our experience of it, or you'll smell a smell and there's your, you know, you're in your Aunt Carol's living room. But that, when it comes back, in a weird way, and that's when we talk about a flood of memory. It's a flood. Mm-hmm. And it comes back, and if you really pay attention to it when it happens, one, you'll notice it happens all day long. The other thing you'll notice is that the thing that comes back isn't a photo of Aunt Carol's living room. It's actually three-dimensional. If I asked you, if you're in Aunt Carol's living room, and I say, well, what are you looking at right now? And then what's to your left? And what's to your right? And what's behind you, it's an image you can actually turn around in.
So there's something cinematic about it.
It's cinema. Well, it's even bigger than cinema. Cinema is cinema. The camera can turn around, but you can't necessarily turn around in the movie. In an image, you actually can turn around. And so my writing class is based on this idea that we have these associative memories and that we have, I don't want to say natural storytelling ability. I do think we do have natural storytelling ability, but we know how to tell a story if we have only a short amount of time to do it. So the trick in the example I give is, say that you and a coworker both hate this other coworker. You know, we'll call her a Twinkie. Oh, so you call each other. You're not gonna believe what Twinkie did today. And then and you think you have 5 minutes to go on about Twinkie, and the other person hates Twinkie too, so it's delicious. Then you realize, no, you got a meeting. You only have 2 minutes. You'll condense that. Almost everybody knows how to do that, and we know how to do that from probably around adolescence is when we start to really have that skill.
So is that truncating a piece of storytelling? You're saying we automatically know how to, if we've only got 2 minutes, we know how to give it a beginning, middle, and end.
Absolutely.
And get to the good stuff.
Yeah, as long as we're not writing it and we think it's literature, if we're just talking about a friend, we know how to do that. And we also know where the story begins. And one of the things I often tell my students is, it's like if you go to when they used to have record stores, you go to the record store and there's, go to the art supply store where it's all these snooty art students who are there and like looking at you like you sad menopausal woman buying art supplies. How tragic.
You've been eavesdropping on my life.
You know how they give you this look? And then they give you this look and you kind of, or they'll say something that makes you feel bad. And then you go back to your car and you suddenly realize what you could have said that would have made them go, oh, you know, I'm melting. And so what do? You don't, when you're driving home, you don't go, oh, I wish I had said that. No, in your head, you start again and you know right where the story starts. I'm walking into this art supply store. I pick up these Chinese Chinese hand ground inks, and I go to the front, and he gives me this look.
Says, "Do you know what these are?"
Or like, one of them was when I said to somebody, "I said, do you know how to use this?" And he goes, "No, because I'm not into ripping other people's cultures off. No, I'm not into ripping off other people's cultures." You know,
and ouch.
I know, and I was like, burr, 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 burr. And but I always come up with what you could have said that would have gotten them back. And when you're driving home, so you start the whole scenario again. You walk in, you get the stuff, he says this, you say that, and he feels terrible. You feel better. Then what do? You imagine it again, don't you? I mean, don't you like go through it like 8 times? You're editing it until finally it's this little gem that makes you feel better. And then when you call your friend and tell them that's what you did say, you're not really lying. That's what I call autobifictionalography. It's what you should have said. You know what I could have said. But I think that if you look at how the storytelling or stories come up in our days all day long, it only takes you starting to be aware of it. You know, like that smell thing, when you smell something and it happens so fast, it's such an astonishing event that while you're talking to somebody, suddenly this whole thing comes and then it goes away again.
So why turn this into a writing workshop or a workshop or a method at all if we all do it all day long anyway?
Because we do it all day long anyway, most people don't really understand that. They think that when you're writing a story, it's something that's very different from what we do all day long. Anyway, if it was that different, then I don't think we could use it. I mean, we are able to use stories because they're already part of our lives. And so what I like to do is show people in how in 7.5 minutes, particularly if you have an unexpected word, so say this is the structure of my class, and I've taught it to, you know, from grad students to medium security prison in Philadelphia, and it works. The only difference is the prisoners' stories always have cops in them. Actually, what got those guys in prison makes them good writers, which is they don't have a lot of second thoughts about, you know, I think this is a good sentence. They really tore it up. Actually, they were quite good writers. But what happens is, so what I do is I'll say, okay, number of page from 1 to 10. And I want you to think back to early days. Just think back to early days in your life. And you kind of picture something from your earliest days of your life. And I say, okay, now, if you were going to tell the story of your life just using the word kitchen tables, just write down the first 10 kitchen tables or memories that come to you. And I give people a short amount of time. You have 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. And then at the 1 minute mark, I say you have about another more minute.
So you and have, all they're doing is listing kitchen tables.
They're listing kitchen tables. Yeah. And also feeling how like 5 will arrive and then nothing, just blank, like the desert. And then 1 will arrive and then nothing. And then 1 will arrive and you go, oh, that one's stupid. But you know, you need 10. So you'll put that stupid one down. That stupid one often, although it won't be the first one that you'll pick when you're first starting out, that stupid one often will have such a story attached to it. But anyway, so what I have people do is they've made that list. Then I have them go down the list and pick one that seems vivid to them. You know, mm-hmm. So let's go with, you know, my Aunt Carol's kitchen table, her dinette set. And so I'd have people circle that. And then I ask them some questions. I have them draw a big X on a piece of paper. And the only reason to draw the giant X to X the entire page out, so you draw an extra line from one corner to the other, is that we already know that this page isn't the real thing. It's already crossed out. So now
so it doesn't count. So now we're
cross
free.
It out first, then write on it. Because I think we had it backwards. We'd write on it and then cross it. It's like, no, let's get that part over with. Okay, we already know it's going to be terrible. So we'd cross it out. And then I start to ask people simple questions. So if you're thinking about a kitchen table, you might as well just have one in your head right now. Any table, it doesn't matter. And so I'll ask questions like, where are you? Where's this table? See, then you'd write, I'm in Aunt Carol's kitchen. And what time of day or night is it? People are surprised they know. And then I'll say, well, what season is it? And then sometimes people will go, what if I'm not sure? And I'd say, well, write down, not sure. and then at this question, a simple question, where's the light coming from right now? So it makes you see the source of the light. Is it coming from the windows? Is it coming from this particular lamp? It also lets you see where the light is falling. And you'll find that the back of your mind has answers to these questions and it makes you excited because you haven't thought of this stuff in a really long time. So we go through all that and I ask them everything, like what's in front of you, what's to your right, what's behind you, this whole thing of just looking all around you. And then I have them during the first workshop, I have them write for 7.5 minutes, beginning with the words I am and writing as if it's happening right now. I am sitting on the ripped Naga hide chair of my Aunt Carol's dinette set, you know, like putting my finger and then remember how they'd tear. You put your finger in there and then she'd scream at you or peeling the duct tape off of the way we try to. So
full disclosure, I've taken a couple of your workshops and it's astonishing the way it works. And I think everybody in the room usually has the same feeling of astonishment. Like, whoa, where did this come from? I didn't know I even remembered that table or that year or that car or whatever.
And that there's often an emotion. The interesting thing about these stories is they'll be little short stories. I mean, they don't even fill a page necessarily if typed up. And they'll have something in them. And so what happens is people think I'm a genie, which I think is fantastic. Go ahead and think that. But anybody can do this. And I always tell people that if you really – there is a monetary reward for knowing how to teach somebody this, which is you'll get free beer for life. If you just go in a bar and you start writing and somebody comes up to you and says, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm a writer. I'm writing. They go, oh, God, I always wish I could write. And I'd say, well, I think you can. No, I can't. I said, well, think of a car from when you were little. So they'll think of a car, and I'll say, are you inside the car or outside? And they go, inside. I say, what seat? Back seat. They're looking at me like this. I go, all right, is it, what time of day is it? And I'll ask them all these questions. And then right when they're getting excited, I'll order a beer and they'll say, no, I'll get that beer for you. And I go, all right. So see, so it pays off.
Well, you brought in a couple of stories that people have written in your workshops. Can you read one just to give us an example of what sort of thing comes out?
Yeah. I think the word that I gave was, I think it was Thanksgiving dinner. This is by Carol Wickersham. And this is the first draft, and it was written in 7.5 minutes. I'm sitting at the grown-up table for the first time. Kids at the card table are already eating the rolls. We're waiting for the prayer. We never pray. Our heads are bowed, but we're looking around. Aunt Isel's wig is drooping over her eyes. Next to her, the famous pink Jell-O mold salad with olives that you can wear on your thumbs if you're at the kids' table. We're waiting for Dad to pray. He never prays. What's he going to say? TV, football, first down, 10 yards to go. Now a word from our sponsor. What will I reach for first? And then he reaches over with beery breath. Slap, get your damn hair out of your plate. My braids are yanked back. Tears fall onto my empty plate. I'm wishing I was at the kids' table. My mom squeezes my knee under the table and whispers fiercely, Bill, pray, damn it, so we can eat. He belches and starts. Dear God, in the year ahead and the year behind, may we all perish. Amen. I reach for the rolls, but Aunt Isel beats me, and she plops some of her pink foamy Jell-O on my plate.
I love it.
Oh, pray, damn it, so we can eat.
The thing I love about that is that's 7 minutes. It's such a complete story.
Yeah. It is. And they kind of have this quality. They're very different kinds of stories than one that's been labored over, where you know that every sentence is moving toward this one thing. It's a different kind of writing, but it's vivid to me and really satisfying. And part of the reason why I'm so in love with teaching it is because I love the stories that people write. I mean, the stories that people come up with. You know, my friend Kelly Hogan, the great singer, describes the class as, she goes, well, the way I explain it is that you blow your mind with your own mind.
So here's the thing. Having taken the class, I know that people who take this find this whole process deeply pleasurable.
Mm-hmm.
There is something, it's hard even to put into words how satisfying this is. Why is that, do you think?
Well, I think there is something incredible. I think it's satisfying in the way good art is satisfying, that thing that we call art, which usually isn't satisfying. Usually art, the thing that art has turned into is you go to a museum or a gallery and you stare at the art and you feel really stupid. It feels like you're in an intensive care unit. Everything's really expensive and you have to behave this certain way, and there are lots of people who are experts. That's not what, people don't get to experience art that much. But when you have a really good conversation with a stranger, or when you read a fantastic book, or you hear a piece of music, or maybe you're lucky enough to see something visual where you actually can see it. The way that I always imagine a painting that I didn't understand, if I saw it in a gallery, I just imagine hanging in a gas station. And then I could look at it, you know? Then I had no problem. So I feel like it's that kind of satisfaction. It's a satisfaction of I guess I'd call it an artistic experience, that there is a satisfaction about it. And that satisfaction is more important for me than what happens to the piece afterwards.
Mm. So there's all this neuroscience now about brain function and creativity. You started by saying you call this process writing the unthinkable, which suggests it's writing with a different part of the brain, maybe. Do you think that?
Absolutely, I do. I don't. I've been really interested in the work of this brilliant guy named Ian McGilchrist, who's written a book that I actually cried the whole way reading, not from emotion, but because the type was really small and it was really dense, and it would take me. I read the book on a schedule. I tried to do 25 pages a day of it, and it would take me 3 hours to read 25 pages.
I hope it was worth it.
Absolutely worth every minute. I'm starting my second reading of it, and I plan to teach a class based on this book. And it's called The Master and His Emissary, The Making of the Western World and the Divided Brain. But one of the things that he's done is he's written brilliantly about how we kind of have two brains. To talk about the left side and the right side of the brain, it can be too simplistic, you know, in a way, but one can say some general things about it. And one can say that the left side of the brain, which is the brain I'm using, the part I'm using right now to speak and use language, likes the parts of things. It likes technology. It likes logic. It likes purpose. It likes utility. It's the part of it's the parent in you that when you say I want to be an artist says, well, then I'm not paying for school. Yeah, hell no. It's that side. No, you're going to do something that you can make a living. So it's all about function and utility, and it's quite an important part of the brain. The other side is where we respond to music, poetry, metaphor, things as a whole, our experience of actual depth and distance. And so I think that, well, and there's lots of studies that would support this, that while both sides of the brain always work in concert, kind of like our two hands, there's never just one side working. The studies that McGilchrist talks about, there are theories that in a weird way, part of the function of the brain is to shut the other side up. You know what I mean? It'd be like Well, either side can shut up. You know, I mean, you can't just have the left brain doing everything or the right brain doing everything. And here's an example of that's from the book. One of the ways to solve really intractable epilepsy, it's a drastic way, but one of the ways is to sever the bridge between the two sides of the brain. It's called the corpus callosum. I always think of it as like looks like two little fists hold or two little hands holding each other, kind of. So they sever that. And when they sever it, it turns out that even if the sides of the brain can't talk, or if one side's even completely not functioning, we still can roll on. Mm. We can roll on pretty much fine, pretty much normally. But there's this period for some people where when that brain is divided, when that little bridge, which is the bridge that has the stoplight on it, mm-hmm. When that's gone, then both sides are in play. And they talk about these people who have the most peculiar experiences. In the book, one of the things he talks about is this woman who would want to get dressed in the morning to go to work. So her right hand would reach for the outfit she should wear to work. And the left hand had a whole different idea and would grab an entirely different dress. And she could not get the left hand to put that dress down. And she talks about having to call her daughter in to come and just... And or when she was trying to pay, or it was a different woman actually, trying to pay for something at the store that the right hand thought it needed, the right hand would hand the money over and the left hand would just take it right back. And if you think of that this war, I mean, it's visible here. It's because that stop sign wasn't there between the two sides of the brain.
So are you saying that you think that the writing process you've come up with is... This is the right brain doing the writing?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
And I think the left, and this is my little theory, and maybe, you know, it could be full of baloney, but I think the thing I know about the left side of the brain is the left side of the brain is a grasping, also grasps, it's our precision grip, you know, the way we mm-hmm. hold a pen. And I believe that writing by hand actually takes up the left side of the brain. It's like writing by hand makes it so the left side of the brain's kind of satisfied. I'm doing something. I'm holding this pen. And so that because it's sort of engaged, I always feel like the right side of the brain can come forward. And that's why I think we doodle in a funny way. I think we doodle to shut the left side of the brain up, like during a meeting uh-huh. where that's really, really boring, but you know... I think it's sort of like handing a kid a crayon. It's like, you know, I know you want to talk through all this, but just draw. And so I've found that it's much easier to listen and concentrate if I'm actually drawing like a little doodle. Usually I do a spiral. And with my students, when they're listening to stories being told, I always have them drawing or coloring a picture, just coloring. You know, that thing that's supposed to be so uncreative, coloring in a coloring book. The ability to remember stuff if you're doing something with your hand. And I always talk about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, our Supreme Court Justice, who has knit her way through her entire... Can you imagine sitting across from Scalia and all those guys and they're arguing some crazy stuff and she's like, click, 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 click.
I don't know, I just keep seeing Madame Dufarge knitting in the foot of the guillotine. But I mean, do you think then that people who type their creative output on a keyboard are writing from a different place?
No, they're not necessarily writing from a different place, but the problem is that the keyboard invites the critical side to hop right in. The keyboard says, oh, I wrote this sentence, and instead of just going to the next sentence and going to the next one, you write that first sentence, and then the left side of the brain will go, let's try that one again. I don't know if you need that word in there, and why an adverb? And so you'll keep just pestering that one sentence, and you'll never get the gesture through. So I think that what a keyboard does is it invites that delete button. I always say if I had a delete button on my life, I'd only have like 27 minutes that I'd keep.
So is this why you, one of the reasons you think this process is so pleasurable for people, because in so much of our life is governed and, you know, controlled by the left side of the brain, and the right side really wants to come out and play, and we don't let it do that all that often, or there aren't all that many opportunities for it to do so.
Yeah, or there's only one, you're only supposed to do it this one way. I think we understand all the arts, all that stuff with that side of the brain. With the right side, well, again, I'd say the back of the mind, top of the mind. That's what I use, because the right side, left side is just, it just gives you too black and white of a picture. But one of the things, I lost my little train of thought. I know what it is. I think one of the reasons why this is so pleasurable, it's not just because the experience of writing and remembering is pleasurable. That's true. But it carries out into the world, and when you finish doing it, the world looks more alive.
Why is that?
Because we've kind of come alive. The back of the mind has an entirely different relationship, actually, to visual stuff, to depth, and to seeing things as a whole, versus seeing things in little parts. And I think that that's part of the function, is that's a more alive, less worried way to be. I mean, I think we need both sides, but I think what this work does, along with the side effect is you get some good stories, is it does make you feel more whole and more alive. And that's what I think the function of the arts is. I mean, I think it is our external organs. You know, but what happens is that people think if they can't make money or if it doesn't have utility, then get rid of it. We're seeing that happen, you know, like with cursive handwriting, that's no longer taught in the schools. But it's sort of like, to me, somebody saying, unless you can find a way to make some money off of your liver, it's gone. It's going, because you could be thinner without that liver. You look so much better. You know, it's like, or something about this idea, you know, that where I have, my friend Kelly Hogan, who used to be a genius with remembering phone numbers, everybody's phone number, she doesn't anymore because she has it in her little mobile device, right? Mm-hmm. So what do you think about this idea of taking a piece of your brain and putting it in an object that you have to buy? Does that sound like a good idea? We're doing it. But because we're doing it with a car, too. We're putting our bodies in an object, and it got me here today. But
so I think I hear you saying that we're not only hardwired to tell stories, but we're hardwired to make art, to make something out of our stories, and that's a crucial part of our mental health, I guess.
Well, I think we're hard, not necessarily to make them, but to use them, to understand the things in life, you know, the deeper things in life. I think that, and I think the other thing, I think the thing we are hardwired to do is use our hands. And I think it's amazing to find that's the one thing that's really being taken away, like using our hands. And if you there have been countless studies that have reproduced these results over and over again, which is they take a group of people who had to solve a puzzle, two groups of people. So one group had to solve this puzzle. It's a physical puzzle. They had to solve it. So that first group, they come in and they describe how they did it. And they time how long it takes people to describe how they solve the puzzle. Mm-hmm. Then they bring the second group in, and they have to do the same task, only they have to sit on their hands while they're describing it. And they have a much harder time saying what happened, and they have a much harder time. It takes much longer to explain stuff. And that alone is sort of interesting. You know, I mean, if you watch people, we all
why would you need your hands to talk?
Right.
That's interesting.
And why do you need your hands to talk when you're wearing your little Bluetooth ugly thing attached to your ear. You're a businessman, you know, at O'Hare Airport screaming at somebody and using their hands. I love to watch people when they're on their phones, especially if they're mad at someone. And especially, it's usually those business guys. People don't wear them anymore, but you remember how that was the thing? I just wanted like seven of them everywhere I went. I just had them all over my body, like little leeches. But watching those people is fascinating because they're in full gesture. They're using both hands when they're talking, because they're not having to hold that other one. So what's it doing? You know, and then what happens when we take it away?
Well, that gets back to the importance of sitting in that workshop and writing down a story with nothing but a pen or a pencil, that there's something really primal about that.
Yeah. And it's important to do it for a short amount of time, so you don't have like all day to do it. It's important. The 7.5 minutes makes all the difference. It's that same thing of talking about that evil person we work with, Twinkie. You know, I only have 2 minutes to tell you, but I can tell you, you know, how she drove me crazy today. And so I feel like that stuff's there. I feel like it's really important to our sense of well-being and our happiness, and that it's being phased out so systematically. It's almost like if I was a real paranoid person, I'd feel like there was a monster somewhere who had figured this out. Let's get rid of the music in the schools. Let's get rid of all this stuff, you know. Let's get rid of it. Let's make it so that we don't have any reliable, uninterrupted time.
And just turn into the pod people.
Yeah. Well, that's McGilchrist's book is sort of that idea that the left hemisphere loves itself and it loves its things of itself. So it really doesn't have any use for the arts. It's not lying. It doesn't. That's not how it uses stuff. So that's pretty interesting to me. And I'm really interested in people who would think about using the arts not to become artists, not to fulfill themselves creatively, but that it makes a certain state of mind that actually makes the rest of what you do deeper and better and more meaningful. And that's where I think the arts come in. And I think that to have them separated, particularly it happens in college especially, where you make your decision. To have them separated, I think, is a little bit like splitting that brain. You know, that after a while, this great, great tool that can help you, that's always helped people understand things metaphorically, sort of atrophies. You know, and but what doesn't atrophy is the longing. You know, people who've played musical instruments, they'll talk to me about how, oh, yes, I used to play the clarinet. God, I loved it. It's been years. And I said, do you still have your clarinet? And they go, yeah. And I said, when you pass it, do you feel guilty? And they go, yeah. I mean, it's almost like they look at the instrument and apologize to it. And then I have students who've taken my class and they'll say, yeah, I wrote a lot after that, but then I haven't written it in a while. And they'll talk about seeing their notebook and feeling bad. What's going on there? There's a living relationship that's going on. I don't feel guilty when I pass my toaster. Oh, I'll get to you. I'll make toast soon. You know, but an instrument, you know, there's like this little heartbreak and it doesn't ever really end. And then you still go to bed with these fantasies. I'm going to pick that up tomorrow for real. I'm going to do it. Or I'm going to write these stories tomorrow. You know, that weird hope. And then you fall asleep and then you don't do it.
Well, thanks for teaching us all to get back to it. Anyway, thanks, Linda.
My pleasure.